Hi, this is Mark Steiner. We are broadcasting today from Annapolis. We were here for the governor's State of the State address and talking to many of our senators and delegates from around the Baltimore area and around the state of Maryland to get their reactions to the state of our state and to the governor's address. We're here with the chairman of the Environmental Matters Committee, our own Maggie McIntosh. And Maggie, good to be in your offices.
Glad to have you here. It's a great office.
Nice
isn't
digs.
It? Yeah, nice digs. Nice digs.
You deserve it.
I do. I think so. Look around the room. Isn't this great? You know, I mean, around the room you see these wonderful photographs of the Chesapeake Bay and the watermen and our history and how important it is to preserve it.
These are good.
Yeah.
These are your photos or the photos that came out of the committee?
No. As a matter of fact, the photographer by the name of Warren, who is well known for his photographs of the bay and the people of the bay, took these, and they're dedicated to the committee by former members of the House of Delegates. So they're actually the property of the this committee, the Environmental Matters Committee.
So tell me, give me your I mean, you've been here now how many years?
This is the beginning of my 19th year, but
right.
Believe it or not.
So you've been and you've been through a lot of politics before that.
I've been through – this is actually the second recession that I have served through. First one I was on appropriations. Now I'm in this position.
And, I mean, I've known you for a long time, and I remember in the beginning days when Mary Pat Clark was first going to run for a citywide office, and that
yeah.
was
– there I was.
And there you were.
Jumping at the bit. Let's do it.
So I'm curious with the perspective on history mm-hmm. and where we are now and the mm-hmm. economic crisis we face. Mm-hmm. Talk about your analysis of – the governor's State of the State address.
I'd be happy to, because one of the things that I talked about on the campaign trail this summer, and I continue to say, is that this governor and this legislature, the leadership in this legislature, has guided Maryland through this time in a very differently than we did in the early 90s during that recession, very differently. And thus far, it has helped us actually preserve our priorities, as the governor says, and at the same time, we have been able to avoid becoming a part of the problem, okay? Part of the problem meaning that in the early 90s, we actually exacerbated the recession. We laid 5,000 state workers off. We cut the capital budget along with the operating budget. And so therefore, the jobs in the construction industry and the building trades disappeared in the state of Maryland for the most part. So, you know, we've done it differently. We've kept a very robust capital budget, you know, through this. And we have tried to fund K through 12, public education, public safety, and keep our priorities through this by, I think, in large part, by the help we got from the Obama administration, but also just by tightening the belt in different places.
What do you think about those who think that the speech was very forward-looking in terms of the future, mm-hmm. but didn't address the issues we're facing right now in the state of Maryland?
Yeah, well, I think it was forward-looking because and I don't fault certainly the governor for that, because he has presented a budget that is balanced, that if we wanted to as a legislature, we could pass it today and
go home early?
Not go home early. We got a couple other bills floating around here, but we could, you know, basically say that's done.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think there are going to be changes that the legislature will want to make to the budget. I think there will be cuts in places, renegotiation with the governor. He certainly left the door open for that, where he said this is the first step. And mainly, I would say, at least in my opinion, the one area that I think we have to look at in the budget and say, whoa, we are really behind the eight ball here, and we've got to do something. That's transportation. I mean, he talks about the red line. He talks about the purple line. There's the green line. There's the yellow line. There's a lot of lines waiting in the queue to be built so that Maryland can compete with other major states, and so Baltimore and the D.C. suburban area can compete with other major cities. And we need a transit system, A, that works, and we need new transit, and we need to figure out how to do that. So I just will say to you that, you know, the transportation piece of the budget has suffered greatly through this recession. And that would lead us to, you know, some people talk about a gas tax. But, you know, I think that we are going to look at, are there other revenue streams that we could use? Well, we've over the years taken, as an example, car registration, a lot of fees associated with automobiles, you know, car rentals, you know. We've done a lot of thinking outside the box to get revenues for various things. You know, maybe there should be another dedicated fund that goes into transportation.
It's part of the problem that we've been kind of raiding that fund.
Yes, it is. And, you know, I mean, that's been one of the transfers that's been ouch, you know. And we're just keeping up with all of the transportation needs, you know, and the infrastructure needs. I don't think any state is. I think that's one of the major crises facing this country is, you know.
So how do you begin to address that in the long term? I mean, the governor talked about thinking about the next generation.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think about the next generation, you either take one or two routes. I don't know if there's – maybe there's another one you can tell me.
Mm-hmm.
One route is cut back government drastically to almost to bare bones.
Mm-hmm.
And leave the money in my pocket and don't bother me because we got. Mm-hmm. I need to build my life. Or we have to invest as a government, mm-hmm. as being the people, mm-hmm. and which means raising revenues, going after corporations, more money out of our pockets. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, we've got to figure out a way to deal with this, and I haven't heard the governor or anybody really talking about that.
Well, actually, we are going to have that dialogue this time. Let me give you an example of, you know, investing and – I'm going to switch just a little bit to the Chesapeake Bay.
That's fine with me.
Let's talk about what goes on in Maryland right now. I'll give you a great example. One of the things that's very detrimental to the Bay is the continued proliferation of septic systems throughout the state that the governor addressed today in his address. He said, we ought to stop it. Stop putting in the older systems. There are better systems. Some that will absolutely, eliminate or help eliminate a lot of the flow of going into the Chesapeake Bay that's actually hurting the bay. And we got to do better. There are, you know, better technologies, and we need to convert to those and have new homes be built with those. That's one. Two, we need to also face growth in Maryland. Make sure that growth goes where there is the capacity to have it, and make sure that growth doesn't continue just to gobble up agricultural areas in the state. And so one of the ideas that we're talking about this term in this committee is maybe once and for all we say, look, you can't do any large developments without hooking them up to water and sewer, public water and sewer. Stop doing, you know, when you look at these major developments around the state, outside the growth envelope, they're all on septics. They are, and it's been that way for decades, and that's bad, all right? So maybe we ought to just say no more major developments unless you do. And that sounds so easy, doesn't it? But you know what?
I raised my eyebrow when you said it, because that would be a battle to say no more.
That's a battle, all right? And here's the – and they'd say, well, you know, the municipalities, the counties say we can't afford to do water and sewer. But here's what developers do. They get the counties to let them do these developments by building schools, by building roads, by building all this stuff, but they don't build the septic, the sewer and water. So I'm just saying, look, if you're not going to ask the developer to do it, if you're not going to they'll build schools, but they won't build, you know, infrastructure. Somebody has to pay attention to the non-sexy stuff because it has a direct relationship to the Chesapeake Bay. So they'll build schools, but they'll put additions on schools, but they won't do infrastructure. So I'm going to take up this term, the non-sexy issue of infrastructure. That's investing. That's an investment. And you look, I'll give you one more story that tells you why we have to do this. We have to also look at retrofitting. You know that we have terrible spills of raw sewage into the Chesapeake Bay from our old wastewater, I mean our old stormwater systems. You live in Baltimore area.
Mm-hmm.
When you go to turn on your faucet in the morning, that cold water, you know, to brush your teeth, when you call that water up from, you know, the Loch Raven Reservoir, by the time it gets to your faucet, 35% of the water is gone. The Johns Hopkins School of Engineering scientists will tell you that in the major metropolitan areas in this state, we lose up to 35% of our water. Statewide, we lose about 10% on average. That we have to fix.
Well, let me ask this, in a few minutes we have left. I mean, so how do we do it and how do we pay for it? A sewage engineer who's working in Washington, D.C. now said to me, that, and he's working on how to fix the system in D.C. He said, nobody even really knows how much this is going to cost us. We've got to fix the system, but nobody knows. So how do you begin to do that? Where's the money coming from, and how do you begin to put your hands around this one?
Well, we figured out a way to do wastewater treatment plants with a flush fee. And I'm going to look at, and we are going to figure out by next session, a mechanism to fund the debt on capital bonds to actually begin the work on retrofitting
and putting people to work at the same time.
Absolutely.
So do you see new revenues coming out of this?
I don't see too many
session.
I think, yes, there will be some. And if I had to guess, it's going to be in the area of health, possibly, you know, possibly the liquor tax. I mean, I support that. I co-sponsored it. I think also we do have to look at new transportation funding. I don't know what that will be, but I think that's very possible, those two. And then next year I think you'll see new fees, new revenues to try to address infrastructure.
Now, there are some other issues coming up. And people say this will be the first time that gay marriage hits the floor.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Even the man who opposed it, Senator Miller, said it'll hit the floor.
Mm-hmm.
So, what do you think about his chances? What do you think is going to happen with the gay marriage bill? What's the official title? It's called. It's not called gay marriage. It's
protection. I don't know.
Whatever.
You know,
yeah.
Look, it's gay marriage. It's same sex marriage. It's
right.
Time has come. Thank you very much. You know, I'm very happy about this, as you know.
Yes.
And I do think it's going to hit the Senate floor. I think the Senate is very close to having the votes that they need. I will have to say that Senator Kettleman is, a very brave
Republican senator.
Yeah, very brave man,
County.
and a wonderful leader. And I am forever grateful. And by the way, his father was one of the only two Republicans that voted for the public accommodations bill several years ago.
Is that
he
right?
He served
in the 1960s you're talking about?
No. It was during the Glendening administration, the public accommodations bill. I think it was 2000.
Oh, I'm sorry. Right.
He was a
different
delegate.
Era. Right,
he was
right,
a delegate.
Right, right.
And he was the minority leader in the House of Delegates and voted. So, I completely understand where the good senator's coming from. I do think, by the way, we're very close and will fairly, not easily, but, you know, I think we're going to have the votes in the House, too. 58 co-sponsors, a great show of support, you know. You only need 13 more people. And, in fact, a lot of people missed co-sponsoring it or have said, I don't want to co-sponsor, but I'm going to vote for that bill. I mean, people, attitudes have changed.
Mm-hmm.
There's a greater understanding of the whole many of the issues.
About time.
Yeah, and it is about time. It's time to stop hating.
Yes, it is. Delegate Maggie McIntosh, thank you for inviting us into your offices, and it's a pleasure to talk to you.
Wonderful to have you. All right, thanks.
Thank you, thanks. Senator Catherine Pugh?
Yes.
Thank you for letting us come into your office here in the state Senate office building.
Yeah, welcome to Annapolis.
Thank you.
It's great to have you here.
Thank you. So what's your assessment of the governor's speech?
Well, I thought it was a very interesting speech. It was a very forward-thinking speech. And in fact, I think much of his speech dealt with the future of Maryland as he sees it. I'm not so sure it focused as much on where we actually are today.
So
in terms of the $1.6 billion deficit that the state is currently facing, and what is actually happening with the budget as we speak, in terms of the cuts that have been made, I think when the governor talks about through the campaign that he would not have taxes and so forth, and that he was going to balance this budget on cuts, he has cut this budget. And when you look at Baltimore City, for example, a public school system that is finally moving forward, doing mm-hmm. some really great things, great CEO of our school system, doing some wonderful, innovative, and creative things, and that's simply because not just because of his creativity, but certainly we've been able to fund the school system. And now we're looking at $100 to $150 cut per student. That certainly is going to have an impact on the classroom and the resources and so forth that are going to be available to those students. And in the city of Baltimore, and I can speak specifically about our city, we can't afford that. We really can't afford those kinds of cuts. And I just think that, and I think President Miller said it best when we were in Senate Democratic Caucus meeting, I mean, there are things that people want and things that people need, education being the key. And as the governor consistently said in his message, we've got to invest in education. We've got to innovate. Well, if we're going to invest in education, we got to certainly start at the public school system level first, because we want to give those children an opportunity, one, to be able to graduate. If we're going to close, as the governor said, let's close the graduation time period in which students are entering college and leaving college. Well, if we're going to do that, then that means we're going to continue to invest in education at the public school level so that our children, when they do get to college, they are prepared and can graduate in a four-year period. And if we're going to close the gap as it relates to the period of time in which students graduate, then we're going to look at things like adjunct faculty juxtaposed against full-time faculty at colleges and universities? Are we reducing the adjunct faculty to increase the full-time faculty so that our children, again, have access to faculty members who can give them the time that they need in order for them to move forward? So, I mean, a lot of concerns for me. You know, I thought it was a very forward-thinking, mm-hmm. Innovative, creative, and those are all the things that we need and have to be. You know, bringing manufacturing back to our city, back to our state. I mean, we heard about the plant that's coming for electric cars in Baltimore County. You
right.
know, so you know, all of us are sitting around saying, God, we certainly would love to have a plant in Baltimore City. We certainly would love to have some manufacturing in Baltimore City. And I think one of the most forward-thinking pieces in there was the invest in Baltimore piece. But, you know, when I look at it, I have to look at it from every perspective. You know, what does that mean in terms of African-American business growth in this state? Because we're one-third of the population. We ought to be one-third of the wealth. We ought to be one-third of the representation. But let me just finish it.
Sure, sure, sure.
But as we do that, and the reason I point that out is because when you look at us economically, we're low on the totem pole. But if we don't lift the least of us, it's going to be very difficult for the state to continue to rise. And that's why I point that out, because I believe that smart business people would say, you know, you've got to look at an economic development strategy that increases job creation, job opportunities in every aspect of our community, in every corner of our state.
I mean, the governor did not wrestle with any of the pressing issues we faced.
It's the state of the state address. The state of the state
address. So I'm curious, if you were giving that speech, what would you have said instead? What would you have said specifically about how you get to the goals that you just mentioned?
I would say, first of all, that it's hard for me to think like a governor when I'm not looking to be a governor. But I guess one of the things I would want to look, you know, is that we have to make, and he said it, we have to make hard, tough decisions. But hard, tough decisions means we've got to figure out how do we generate revenue. And I think invest in Baltimore is one of those pieces. Invest in Maryland is one of those pieces. But we got to take care of now so that we can get to the future. So what is it going to take to balance, I mean, to really fix this budget? Because you can't just continue to cut people's jobs. I mean, you just can't continue to do that and not figure out where those people go. Does that mean we need to up our taxes in some way? For example, when we did the sales tax, and Maryland has one of the lowest sales tax in the country, and I purposely went around the country. Everywhere I traveled in the few years before I came back to the General Assembly, first thing I would ask is, what's your sales tax? You know, Georgia, 8 cents, New York, 10, 12, I mean, you know, Pennsylvania, 8, 9, and we were at 5 cents.
Right.
And I remember having this discussion with Senator Joan Carter Conway. We said, you know what? We need to do the sales tax 2 cents across the board and be done with it, because that would help us to get to where we need to go. But we also need for our economic development department to be out there. As somebody said, if I were in the economic development department, I would be out in California trying to grab some of those businesses and bring them and lure them to Maryland. I would probably talk about why I may have to raise taxes. And I think our governor wants us to, the General Assembly, to do taxes, and he be forced into signing the bill. And I'm saying, you know, something's got to give. We can't cut Medicaid and Medicare and all of these health programs and not figure out where we're going to get the money to do it. I mean, there are bills floating around, for example, for an alcohol tax.
Right.
And they want dedicated funding. And every time I say to somebody, I say, well, you know, dedicated funding is one thing, but one-third, you know, I think one-third of our budget, or one-third goes to health care, another third goes to education, somewhere like that. So whether it is dedicated funding or to the general fund, it all ends up being spread out and covering those areas of concern. So I'm concerned about where we're going to be financially with health care. Where are we going to be in terms of this whole concept of invest in education? And I want us to invest in education, but I want our public school systems to be able to continue to move forward. And I think that you got to look at those kinds of things. What do we need to do if we all have to tighten our belts? And as the governor said, there's a role in this for all of us. Then tell me what my role is. Does it mean that for the next 2-3 years that I need to be paying another penny on my sales tax? Does it mean for the next few years that I'm going to have to pay additional gas, a gas tax? Does it mean that there's going to be an alcohol tax that I'm going to have to deal with? Be square with me. Let me know what I need to do. I'm a part of the state. I'm talking about the public. Tell us what we need to do to tighten up so we can move forward.
Senator Catherine Pugh, this has been a pleasure. You've been very forthright and clear, which is what we need to have to hear. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Always welcome them.
Thanks. You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show, Public Radio WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this very short break. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite Magazine's new e-zines. You can get your weekly fix of arts and culture, food and drink, home and design, style and shopping, and green and sustainable topics. Updated information can be delivered to your inbox. Registration is available at urbanitebaltimore.com. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Parkinson's Disease and Movement Disorders Center, providing clinical research trials that evaluate new therapies and the latest treatment options, including surgical intervention for advancing stages of disease. The number for more information is 1-800-492-5538. I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. We are broadcasting today from Annapolis. We were here for the Governor's State of the State Address and talking to many of our senators and delegates from around the Baltimore area and around the state of Maryland to get their reactions to the state of our state and to the Governor's Address. We're here with Delegate Heather Meiser from Montgomery County, Tacoma Park, and another one of our State of the State responses. And Heather, good to see you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for inviting us to your office.
My pleasure. Welcome.
So, your initial analysis, reactions to the governor's State of the State.
Well, as the governor said, the president put out a pretty big challenge to the nation, reminding all of us that we are, as Americans, called to try to outcompete the world. And within this country, Maryland wants to outcompete everybody else. And we have done quite a bit to set ourselves up as one of the leading states in the nation. We are number one in state, federal, and R&D commitments. We have the number one concentration of PhD scientists and engineers. We are rated number two in biotech, and the Chamber of Commerce, which is hardly a mouthpiece for the Democratic Party, has said that we are the number two state in the nation for innovation. All of these things have come together to create a climate where, in Maryland, we understand well that it's up to us to invest in a 21st century economy and then to manage our, to educate our children to manage it. We've had the number one schools in the nation for the last 3 years, and we're building on those commitments. And I think what the governor was laying out for us was that we needed to take stock of where we've come and how we have built up this innovation economy and not stop just because we've been in a recession. There's so much more for us to accomplish over the next 4 years.
Some folks could listen to the State of State, and some have said that the governor's speech was great in terms of his vision about our future, think about where we're going to go, but kind of a little short on what we face at this very moment in terms of the deficit, in terms of how we're going to. No mention all about how we're going to deal with our pension problems. No mention all about how we're even going to get to the place that we have to get to fund what we have. I mean, it was a great speech, but I mean, do you think there was enough there in terms of what we need to talk about right now?
Well, I consider the speech and the budget that he just submitted to us to be hand in glove. And what wasn't mentioned in the speech is contained in the budget. While he didn't go into all those details in his speech because the State of the State address is more about oratorical, high-soaring, feel-good thoughts about our state and where we're headed, he did lay out a very clear roadmap in terms of his proposal for how we deal with this moment in time where we find ourselves facing a $1.4 billion structural deficit. And he gave us his proposed solutions, which were entirely through cuts. And it's going to be up to us in the General Assembly. I'm a member of the Appropriations Committee. We're digging into that budget very deeply right now. And we're going to be deciding, do we take the roadmap that he gave us, which is all cuts, or do we sprinkle in there a discussion about raising revenue in order to have a more balanced discussion about how we meet our priorities? We have an infrastructure that is crumbling. And taking more money from the Transportation Trust Fund to plug budget gaps may not be the best approach. Should we raise the gas tax as a way to bring in enough revenue to start addressing some of our infrastructure concerns? These are the kinds of questions the General Assembly will be addressing. The pension issue. We had a commission that worked throughout the interim to make recommendations on what happens with the pension fund, and they put ideas on the table that included having the counties take a larger portion of the share of the unfunded obligation. You have an investment scenario where we're starting to see the investments tick back up again, which helps close some of that gap that existed in the pensions. The governor's come up with his own proposal related to expecting the teachers themselves to pay more for what they're going to get, maintaining their defined benefit, but moving in a direction where they pay a larger percentage of it. But that came to us in a form where, for the first year, those changes, which save $120 million a year, in year one, they're used to actually plug budget deficit gaps rather than fixing the pension problem. Do we want to go down that direction as a General Assembly? We get revenue estimates in March of every year, which tell us we are in a better situation than we thought we were, or the revenues have continued to fall and we have an even bigger gap to fill. And so that's what this 90-day session is about. There's only one bill we have to pass under our Constitution each year, and that's our budget. And we are very seriously digging into and trying to answer the big questions of the day on how we're going to close it. But he had his opening salvo. He gave us his blueprint for how we could do it in a way that isn't about raising taxes. And then I think we're going to have a broader-based discussion in the General Assembly on whether or not we want to follow that approach or whether or not there should be some other revenues laid on the table.
What do you think? I mean, I'm looking at your wall here, and you have these vintage posters of McGovern, Shriver, and Johnson Humphrey and Carter Mondale, Bobby Kennedy, Jack Kennedy, Roosevelt Truman.
Do you think I might be a Democrat?
You think so? I don't know. You might. Maybe it's camouflage. Maybe you're not really a Democrat at all. And so the Democrats have a belief that, at least have historically, that government has a role to play. But the question is, how do you pay for that role? Mm-hmm. Where does it come from? Some people are arguing that corporations are not paying their fair share in the state of Maryland or anywhere in the United States of America. Folks are saying raise the gas tax. Some people are saying, but if you do that, you're hitting working people. Mm-hmm. Put more money on a drink or a bottle of wine or a bottle of whiskey or six-pack mm-hmm. of beer. Mm-hmm. The money's got to figure out to come from somewhere to do the things we need to do, or you have to kind of cut things back to a bare-bone government. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, what do you propose? I mean, what would you propose? I mean, if you were, you're not in the driver's seat, but you're clearly helping drive the bus because you're an elected member of this House. So what would you say? I mean, what do you think we should do?
I think all good ideas have to be placed on the table. And as far as the gas tax goes, I'm as sensitive as anyone else is to how high gas already is. And particularly for working class families, one thing we've always done in Maryland, or often have done, and I'm a big proponent of making sure we do again in the future if we raise the gas tax, is to have a parallel package of offsets that would help low-income people. For example, we have a very generous earned income tax credit program in the state of Maryland that doubles down on the federal earned income tax. Unfortunately, it's been really undersubscribed. There are a lot of families that don't realize they qualify for this, but it's a refundable tax credit that puts real money into the pockets of working class families pretty immediately. And if we were to raise the gas tax, having some sort of an increase in the earned income credit is something we've often considered. So there are all kinds of policy dials that you can take into consideration. By and large, there seems to be a lot of consensus about the alcohol tax. It hasn't been raised since the early 50s. That's not going to, by itself, close the gap because it doesn't raise enough money. But we're looking for every nickel, dime, and quarter under the couch cushions at this point. We can't leave something like the alcohol tax just sitting there. I don't think, though, any of us are looking to just tax our way out of this problem either. We have to be smart about what we want to invest in our government. And another place that I would applaud the governor is in the creation of the state stat. I think there's more we can do in the General Assembly to take in the interesting data and information that state stat has compiled to make determinations about outcomes and efficiencies and effectiveness of the programs that we're already investing in this state, and continue to put our money where we are getting the kind of outcome that we need, and making decisions in other cases to close down programs that might not be meeting those targets.
There are one of the things that I know that you're deeply involved in is the question that we have energy issues in the state. And one of the things that that we're going to see debated in this assembly is whether or not we're going to be able to drill for gas in Western Maryland, commonly known as fracking, going sideways down into the shale and pulling out the gas. Now, that's one of your issues.
Yes, very much so. We have a situation in this country where in 2005, Halliburton and Dick Cheney, remember them?
I do very well.
They got a special interest exemption in the 2005 Federal Energy Policy Act that said that there would be no federal regulations of hydraulic fracturing. Well, back then it was kind of a throwaway line. Who knew what hydraulic fracturing was? They hadn't started doing it yet. But free from any federal regulations on it, they systematically went into 30-some states that sit on various shale formations. Maryland's one of them. And they began this drilling method completely unregulated. They drill down and horizontally and pump those wells with thousands of gallons of water, dangerous chemicals, and sand to break apart the rock and allow the gas to escape. Now, I don't know anyone that's taking issue with the fuel source. We have natural gas, I think, has an opportunity to be a key to our clean energy future. But it's the extraction method that we are concerned about. Where this has been done in other states, if we look up to our neighbors in the north, Pennsylvania being the closest neighbor who has done this very aggressively, there are communities across that state that have flammable tap water. They can't eat, drink, bathe, cook with the water from their own home. It has to be trucked in from other sources. It has ruined their properties, their lives, their livelihood. Our water is way too precious to ever take for granted, and we cannot get to a place where we do this without thinking through how to have the regulations in place to assure that we don't have regrets later.
You know, what, we'll come to that battle in the coming weeks, because you and others come on the show to debate that particular issue and get that in front of the people. Very lovely picture sitting behind you, and this is one of the issues. It looks like it's going to be coming to the Senate floor will be the issue of gay marriage, and there's a lot of talk that it might pass. Talk about your sense of where that yes. might be in the session.
And for your listeners, the beautiful picture over my shoulder is of my wife and I on Ocean City on the beach. I believe we have the votes to pass marriage equality. Elections have consequences, and we found in this state the consequences were that we came up with more votes to get marriage equality passed than we've had in the past. And there's a lot of momentum behind this. We've done our own internal vote counts, and we definitely think we have both chambers lined up to be able to pass marriage equality. My wife, Deborah, and I, who live in Tacoma Park, there's no reason why we should have to get on the red line to go into Washington, D.C., to the courthouse to get a civil marriage license. We want to take the purple line over to Rockville to be able to do it.
And I think that a lot of people think that Senate President Miller said he's going to let it out of committee.
We have the votes in the floor, too. We've done the vote counts, not just in committee, but in both chambers. We have the 71 needed in the House and the 24 needed in the Senate. It's going to pass this year. The free state will finally stand up and recognize and protect all marriages.
So that'll be momentous if that actually happens in the state of Maryland, having witnessed the battles over the years.
Well, public opinion's changing as well, and that's helping, because as more and more polls come out showing that a majority of Marylanders think that this is no big deal, that's why you're seeing more people line up and go from being tepid to being co-sponsors of the legislation.
And finally, I'm curious if what are the two things that you desperately want to see come out of this session?
I want to see responsible regulations put on this dangerous form of drilling to protect our groundwater and our property rights. And I want to see marriage equality. So two things we've already talked about. I also believe that there's a lot we can do to help expand family planning services to low-income women. And there's a way to do it that will save the state $22 to $40 million a year. The federal government picks up 90% of the cost. So for a $2.8 million upfront investment, we save a lot of money on the back end from the lowering of unintended births. $19,000 per Medicaid-funded pregnancy in this state can go away overnight with increased family planning services. We can lower our infant mortality rate, have healthier moms and babies, empower women to have children when they're ready to have them, and change an arcane rule. Right now, we give this coverage to women only after they've had their first baby. Oh, great. We're going to help them plan baby 2, 3, 4, and 5, but not that first critical pregnancy. So we need to get our foot in the door to do that. The new federal rules allow us to make it based on income eligibility. And when we do that, we're going to have healthier moms and babies and a healthier economy as well.
Delegate Heather Mazier, thank you so much for inviting us to your office and sharing this with our listeners.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here today.
Thanks. I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. We are now with Sean Tarrant, delegate from Baltimore. He's getting ready to start his second term.
Yes, sir.
In office. And Sean, good to see you. Thank you for inviting us into your office.
Well, thank you, and thanks for coming down to Annapolis.
Always good. This is actually my first time in this new office of yours, isn't it?
Oh, yes. Last year I was on the third floor, and now I'm on the fourth floor. things are going well. As a matter of fact, I'm now one of the deputy majority whips. So that was a recent promotion. So I'm charged with finding out what are people's issues in my particular committee and making sure that we whip the votes so they'll pass on the floor. So new deputy majority whip, and I'm on the fourth floor.
On the fourth floor. So we all heard the governor give his state of the state.
Right.
Let me just ask you this first. From your perspective, what is the state of the state? Did O'Malley hit it? Were things missing? Was it all there? What is the state of the state from your perspective?
The state of the state from my perspective is kind of give a roadmap of where do we see Maryland going for the next 4 years and beyond. And I think the governor did a nice job of kind of recapping where we've been over the years, that we've had some tough times, and times are still tough. I mean, that's the sad thing is that, you know, the governor's got to give another state of state address, still talking about budget deficits, cutbacks, programs having to be reduced, services and things like that. So that's what he had to do today. But he did it in a way to talk about innovation, and also that we still, for the third year in a row, have the best public schools out of all the states out there, that Maryland is number one. So he did hit upon some of the positive things that were going on, and he talked about how we actually had a huge drop in foreclosures that were leading the nation as far as making sure people stay in their homes. So he was talking about some of the positive things about it, but unfortunately this economy is just so rotten, and it continues to be rotten.
So some of you might argue that it was a great address, very inspiring, which is what you're supposed to do for the state of the state, as everybody keeps saying. And he delivered a good one. But there are a lot of brass tack issues to deal with that are in the budget but weren't delivered today. I mean, how are we going to raise the funds? Do we need to raise the funds to do things the state has to do, or do we start cutting the government back? I mean, how do you see that? I mean, people are talking about a gasoline tax. People are talking about stuff that's not even on the table, like corporations not paying their fair share, some people would argue.
Right.
I mean, so what are you and the other delegates going to be debating when it comes to cutting, raising revenues in this session?
Well, the governor didn't mention those things because he's not going to do them. He's going to leave it to the legislature to raise taxes and also cut programs. So we're talking about the gas tax, and it seemed like there is some interest in doing that. The alcohol tax, even though that started off with some of the leaders in Annapolis not being interested, now they're even considering on your show, President Miller kind of said that he might consider that. So those things are really for the legislature. It was going to be a part of his address because he's going to put that responsibility on us as the elected body to actually go out and see if we're going to have the votes to be able to have a gas tax. Also, he has suggested that what we can do is have the new people come into the state pension system go from 5% to 7%. They're going to have to put in more money, as well as the people who are currently in the system. They will be held, you know, harmless. But the thing is, these are things that, you know, he would like to see done, but it really comes down to the legislature in both houses. Do we really have the votes to get things done as far as the revenue enhancers so we don't cut too many programs out? So retirement is on the, you know, as far as doing something different with that. The gas tax, alcohol tax, and there are some others out there that will come up as session goes on because not everything is on a table. There's even some talk about expanding gambling. I mean, to have it where you'd have table games. And I feel in Baltimore City, in an area that has a lot of tourism, and folks always tell me, you know, I don't go downtown because I ain't paying for parking. Well, when we get slot machines down there and we get, you know, table games, don't come downtown. Let the people from outside gamble. Don't gamble with your money as you need to be spending on your family and giving to faith-based organizations. So I think that those are the kinds of things that we're going to have to discuss about where these revenues are going to come from to keep things moving forward.
Do you think that gambling will expand? Do you think that's going to happen this session?
Well, I would say that there's a good chance that something different will happen in gambling because whenever you have to decide on programs to cut, and you have people like the mayor of Baltimore City, you have Dr. Andres Alonso saying that, hey, do whatever you can. Don't let them cut us anymore or let us get this increase. And then your back is against the wall, so it makes you vote for things you would not normally vote for. I was here for the special session in 2007. That was only 3 weeks. Those 3 weeks were harder than any full-blown 90-day session because we had to make tough choices. There were a lot of members that didn't want to raise the sales tax from 5% to 6%. There are people who said, no way would I vote for any slots bill, and they did. You know, you can say what you're not going to do, but when people start talking about taking something away, then you say it's not so bad. Look at Congress. Everyone's saying, oh, not the millionaire tax. I ain't voting for it. It ain't going nowhere. Hey, it passed. The millionaires and the Bush tax cuts continue because once people get pushed against the wall and they realize that they're going to lose a whole lot, they ain't got no choice. They got to cave in. And so I'm hoping that we don't get to that point.
Not to get stuck on this, just quickly. I mean, you actually think that if we had, and I'm not saying I'm like agnostic on this issue, okay? I'm just doing the interview. So,
you won't use it at home at the dinner table, I know.
So, if you really think if we had gaming tables in downtown Baltimore, in some of the hotels that are already built and ready, waiting for it to happen, waiting ever since they built it. Do you think that the people from the neighborhoods are really not going to come downtown to play those tables?
Well, I think that some people will come down because people have family members visiting from out of town, you know, during the holidays or whatever. Well, the thing is, when you add in, you know, parking and just you're not really going anywhere, you're just going downtown. People, for something like that, they want to really go out of town on those things, people who live in Baltimore City. I'm seeing gambling to be a lot like the Ravens games. When you go down to a Ravens home game on a Sunday morning, it's 10 a.m. and people are out there tailgating. Now, that's not the average Baltimore person down there tailgating. It's folks from other parts of the state. There are people from Pennsylvania coming down to do that. Black folks are in church. They trying to get ready for church. They got, you know, the beans on the stove. You know, they're trying to get the chicken ready. They ain't got time to be going downtown for that. I'm thinking if we had table games downtown, it's going to attract people who are coming for conventions, they're coming for the games, and all of the things, and we can get some of this outside money in there. I mean, I haven't proposed any legislation like that, but I'd like to see that, you know, be considered because we do need revenue enhancers. We really do.
And gaming does track more towards the wealthy than the working man.
Right. Especially if, like, for example, blackjack, instead of having $5 and $10 minimums, make it $15 and $20. And you can do that. You can actually put that in legislation that you don't have, you know, table games that are, you know, geared towards the poor when you have, you know, nickel slots. I mean, come on. That's when you really go down there.
You're on what committee? Bad path. Your committee is the
Health and Government Operations.
Health and Government Operations.
Right.
The governor has said no to the new jail so far. Youth jail in Baltimore City.
Yes.
Right? Wasn't a state of the state, but he said no. It's not right in the budget. The head of juvenile services left.
Yes.
Or was left. He's not here anymore.
Right.
So what I'm not hearing are delegates and senators raising the cry of what we have to do to reform the juvenile justice system, because it seems to be the hardest boat to turn around. Everybody I've interviewed in the last 18 years on the air, every governor, every secretary of juvenile services or juvenile justice or whatever they want to call the department at that moment.
Right.
That we're not talking about how not to lock up young black kids from across the state of Maryland, young kids of color, young people, period.
Right.
And really reforming the system so it works in a different way. Why isn't anybody raising that banner now with this huge opportunity to make that one of the things we debate and question our state leaders about how they're going to change that, given this opportunity with a new person coming in and no new jail?
You know, I'm not sure why that conversation is not happening. I mean, I was one of the ones who's on your show a while back ago saying I was opposed to spending you know, $90-plus million dollars
right
on a new prison when you've got our schools. ACLU did a big report study and found out that, you know, so many of our schools, you know, a large majority of schools needed to be in repair or to be replaced, that we should be spending the money on the kids before they get into trouble. So I'm one of the politicians that, you know, willing and able to have discussion. I was, you know, with the Safe and Sound campaign just yesterday in my office, and they talked about some of the partnerships that they have as far as, you know, be able to collaborate with other groups to make sure that you have public money and private money to be able to save the state money and then also help our children. I mean, that argument has got to be put out there because tremendous opportunities to be able to get children in better programs that when they are released from these programs, they can go back to school or they can start a trade or go to college. That's out there now. And I'm so glad that the governor said there's no money in the budget to build this facility because it wasn't a good thing. And I'm glad that people did stand up. And that was the first thing. So the next thing hopefully will be what I just mentioned as far as people talking about what can we do now creatively for far less dollars and make sure that we don't have kids, you know, recycling in and out of the prison system.
That argument, I mean, that debate needs leaders on the House and Senate floor, though, to make it happen in their committees. Somebody's got to raise the issue.
Well, it's got to be raised in the Judiciary Committee, appropriations. It's got to be raised. It also has to happen with Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake, because I mean, it's in Baltimore City, and so she's got a bully pulpit to decide on. Hey, you know, Governor O'Malley, this is what I see, because a lot of it is, you know, happening to children in Baltimore City. I mean, over 70% of the people that are incarcerated in the state of Maryland are from Baltimore City. So it's our children. So even though we're in Annapolis, decisions are made in Annapolis, it needs Baltimore City politicians to step up.
This may be the year that, pardon me, that gay marriage passes.
Yes. This very well may be the year. There were people that were moved around on certain committees to be able to get it passed out of the subcommittees and out of the full committee and to the House floor. So that seems as if it's going to happen. Yes, it does.
Well, we talked about that a little bit before. I mean, what is so you're voting for that?
When it comes to the House floor, I do plan to vote for it. I'm not on a committee that would actually bring it out of, you know, the committee itself. But when it comes to the House floor, we have a committee system. Usually when bills, when I say usually, I'm talking about upwards of 90%+ of the bills or more, when they come to the floor, they're likely to pass because it's been fully vetted and you've got a cross-section of people on those committees, and so it's likely to pass.
So if one of the issues that are critical to Sean Tarrant this year, what are your issues in this House? What are the issues critical to you?
The one issue that's very critical to me, as a matter of fact, is childhood obesity. Recently, we had a committee meeting talking about the governor has a legislation he's putting in about protecting children. We don't have a child neglect bill in the legislature that is passed. So he wants to have a bill that protects children like we protect pets and like we protect vulnerable adults. And he talks about having children being protected when it comes to malnutrition, things like that. But what about kids who are obese? What's our role in making sure that we keep our children healthy as well? So that's one of the things, you know, that's part of my initiatives, as well as I've got some cigar legislation to make sure that our kids are not smoking. Right. Did that last year as far as protecting kids from smoking. We don't want to create a bench of future smokers. So why have these cherry, grape, vanilla cigars that sold for under a dollar that kind of forces kids into smoking and then they become smokers later on? So I want to put them in packs of four or more, make it more expensive, the kids are less likely to smoke.
We're going to call you back on this because my wife has been together at a conference on childhood obesity at the University of Maryland and with the Morgan School of Community Health and Policy. So Sean Tarrant has to be on that.
Yes, please. Yes, please.
Sean Tarrant, thank you so much for inviting us into your office.
Well, thank you so much, Mark, and take care and get home from Annapolis safely. Thank you so much.
We're going to do our best. We're broadcasting today from Annapolis, and our final interview of the day is here with Delegate Sean Tarrant. After the State of the State address, talking to many people from the House and the Senate about the reactions to the State of the State and their thoughts about where this is going to go in the next few months as they battle out the issues. And so I'm Mark Steiner for 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, WEAA. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Christina Arison. We're engineered by Brian Boone. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. Hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, hear additional interviews, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.